Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. For this Monday, the 23rd of January, David Margolick is going to be joining us this hour. He's written a lengthy piece that's in the current issue of Vanity Fair that looks at National Public Radio, and the title of it is National Public Rodeo. David looks at a number of different issues, the changing management of NPR in the last year and why that happened, the Juan Williams controversy. He revisits that issue. He looks at the role of NPR, the foreign reporting, the fact that huge number of Americans listen to National Public Radio now, and he revisits the question that's been around for a long, long time, and that's whether or not NPR would be better served, although I'm not sure what all the sources of income would be if it did not receive government money. So we're going to talk about NPR this hour with David. And David was last with us in December when his book Elizabeth and Hazel was released. A fascinating, fascinating book. And it was a great interview with David. He's a longtime contributing editor at Vanity Fair, previously worked for Newsweek, Portfolio, and the New York Times, where he wrote the weekly At the Bar column. And in his 15 years at the Times, the paper nominated him 4 times for the Pulitzer Prize. He's a frequent contributor to the New York Times Book Review. He's a graduate of the University of Michigan and Stanford. He's also the author of A Predator Priest, about a family's long quest to bring a pedophile priest to justice. He's written a number of other books as well, and has been an adjunct professor in New York University's Department of Journalism, and he's with us this hour. We'll be welcoming phone calls. We don't talk about NPR very much, so that's why this article caught my attention, and I hope it's not too inside the trade here, but he says a lot of things that listeners, I think, of NPR will find very interesting. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hi, David.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, David.
Thank you for having me, and I'm going to have to make that bio a little bit shorter. It's taking up too much time.
All right, David. Well, somebody's got to say good things every now and then, right?
Well, I think it could use a little bit of editing, frankly. Like a lot of things I write.
Well, I could have gone on. I could have said more. Let's talk about why you decided to do this piece. NPR, we did want to have somebody from NPR on, and they didn't want to do it. They said that this really is old news. Were you looking at, did you want to do a comprehensive piece on what NPR has been going through the last year, or did you want to bring up the question of does it need a new direction? Why did you do this piece now?
Well, the story actually evolved. The story was in the works for a long time, and when I originally heard about it, I wanted to do a piece about the kind of economic problems that NPR was going through. Mm-hmm. This was several years ago when it was laying off people and was going through some economic difficulties. But it changed in the course of my reporting, and of course all of these convulsions occurred within NPR, the Juan Williams matter, and then the hiring and firing of new executive directors at NPR, and the sting in which the NPR fundraiser was caught on tape saying embarrassing things. And there just kept there was a constant series of superseding developments that kept changing the story. So the story evolved in midstream, and then it sat around for a while. So it was a very hard story to stay out in front of, and it kept changing.
Mm-hmm.
My premise was that NPR is an incredibly important institution. There was also, of course, in the middle of all of this, the calls to defund NPR, and NPR was kicked around a little bit like a political football. And I just thought that NPR was incredibly important and underreported. I mean, NPR doesn't really report on itself, and I had never really read anything terribly good about the structure or organization or role of NPR in American life, and whether, in fact, it was endangered or not by all of these problems. And
right.
So I thought it was a good story.
And you talk about being kicked around, which it has been in the last year. And was it kicked around because it laid itself open to being kicked around? Was the management, do you think, of NPR just not on top of these issues, didn't foresee what would happen if Juan Williams were let go, didn't foresee the fact that there were a lot of people who wanted to defund NPR and had to play this a little better than they did?
Yeah, I think that NPR has generally not been, hasn't defended itself very well. I think that there's a certain naivete and insularity to NPR, an inside the beltway kind of mentality.
Mm-hmm.
And it's never really thought very defensively. It's kind of naive. And that would account in part for the firestorm that developed after the firing of Juan Williams. It just wasn't well situated to defend itself, and it sort of has allowed itself to be a bit of a punching bag and has made itself, in my mind, more vulnerable than it really is. And this is one of the things that I write in the article, which I should say is not actually in the Vanity Fair print magazine. It's only on the website of vanityfair.com, so that's where your listeners would find it. But I think NPR has, in a way, sold itself short, because as your listeners know, and as many of the people who are listening to this program know, it's just an indispensable part of their day.
Right.
And it's a fixture on the American journalistic scene. It's become more important rather than less important. More people than ever are listening to it. And there's a reason why more people are listening. It's because that the other networks have sort of abdicated their traditional roles as journalists. They've cut back on their news divisions. And so NPR is more important than ever. And because it's more important than ever, it has more of a political constituency than ever. And because it has more of a political constituency than ever, in a way it's more invulnerable than ever. But it's not acting that way. And it's puzzling why it doesn't act that way. And it makes itself seem so vulnerable when, to my mind, it's really not. And, you know, I think that there are an awful lot of Republicans who listen to NPR. And I think that NPR is stronger than it's given itself credit for being.
Well, and as you write, it's good to remind ourselves of the number of people who listen to this. It's something like 27 million people. That's a lot of Americans.
That's a lot of Americans. And I remember how Rune Arledge on ABC used to say that more Americans get their news from ABC News than any other source. And I'm hard-pressed to think of any other news source than NPR from which more Americans get their news. You know, I mean, everybody listens to NPR. It's absolutely indispensable, and yet it acts timidly, and it acts, you know, it seems frightened, and it's puzzling to me.
And is that partially because there have been these, and it seems like it happens every 4 years or sometimes every 2 years, it's the same argument, well, we've got to defund this organization, you know, it's usually a Republican-led charge, that it's not a fair place, it's not balanced, it's got a political agenda, let's defund NPR, even the president, as you mentioned at one of the gatherings of news people, said, looked over at the NPR table and said, oh, you're still here. It's like constant. It's gone on for years and years
Yeah, there's just a lot of demagoguery involved with it, to my mind. I mean, I don't think that the defunding efforts have been really serious. I mean, it's just a matter of scoring points with the political base. And I think that they never really get very far. I mean, it is true that we're in a budgetary crisis, and NPR may have to be trimmed some. As one of the NPR people told me, we're going to get a haircut along with everybody else as these budgetary matters are addressed. But I think the idea of pulling the plug on NPR is preposterous, and it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen because there's too much of a constituency out there for it. And it's just, it happens to be a convenient political football,
mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that, you know, regularly there are certain people who are pandering to their base, and so they bring it up. But in fact, of course, you know, the amount of money that's budgeted for NPR is infinitesimal in the scheme of the federal budget, and it's really just a bunch of posturing. I mean, I don't think it's the kind of thing that one can ignore. And it flares up periodically. But when was the last time you heard about it? You're not hearing about it now. You know, I mean, it's just it flared up during the Juan Williams business.
Right.
But I think it's since quieted down, and NPR has a new head who seems very appropriate and competent and level-headed. And I think that it's going to subside as an issue until the next time it comes up.
Yeah. You begin the article by talking about the new head of NPR making his debut, you write, at a staff meeting in October, and that there was relief that he was the new head. Why the relief, and is he going to be a superb, do you think, a director of NPR?
Well, I don't know whether he'll be superb or not. I think he seems like a very competent guy, and when I spoke to him, he seemed very confident and comfortable in his new role, and he has a good record. And I think that, you know, there are a lot of hats that the head of NPR has to wear, and he seems to have a good wardrobe for them. He has a very extensive and varied background. I think that people thought that it would be harder to find a head of NPR, given all the demands and the political sensitivities to the job. People thought it would be a more agonizing process, and instead, they just went out very quietly and found this fellow, Gary Nell, who had been with the Sesame Workshop. And, you know, he seems to be a popular choice, and it just seems as if NPR is back on track and that things have quieted down. I mean, my story sat around for a while, and in some ways it was a little bit dated when it appeared, because I think that things have quieted down at NPR, which was one of the reasons why I went more deeply into the Juan Williams story, because I think that that was a more timeless story. So I enhanced that part of the reporting, and of course now with the Republican debate the other night, Juan Williams is very much back in the news.
Right. There was Juan Williams once again,
yeah.
Right? Only in a different, completely different context.
Well, that's right. And, you know, after the debate, Sean Hannity said to him, "You're a troublemaker, aren't you? You like to make trouble." And which I thought was a rather patronizing way of approaching him. But I thought that it was my own feeling was that it was a fine moment for Juan Williams. I think that it was gutsy what he did,
mm-hmm.
by asking the questions that he did. Although at the same time, you know, it made me feel a little bit uncomfortable that the black reporter was the one who was asking all the black and minority related questions. These are questions that should concern all reporters.
Right.
And I thought he'd sort of been ghettoized in a way by being the only one to ask these questions, and not only the only one to ask these questions on Fox, which to its credit even raised these issues. I mean, these issues have simply not come up in any of the debates,
right?
You know, in any of the networks. So I thought that was another reason why what Juan did was very commendable. I'm very critical of him in the piece, because I felt that the story of his dismissal at NPR had not been fully told, or partially told, and that it had been misrepresented in the press, and that there was a much deeper and richer story to be told about his record at NPR. And so that's one of the reasons that I concentrate on it in the story. But I thought that he had a fine moment at the debate the other night.
I've always wondered why NPR, and I think it's true of a lot of stations too. You would think of all the media outlets that NPR would have many, many more voices on the air, and it seems to me as though we're lacking in having a lot of minority voices who are just part of the mainstream conversation. That you seem to see almost more of that now on television than you do on a medium like NPR. Do you think that's right or not?
I think that is right, Kathleen, and I think it's a puzzling thing, and it's one of the things that Gary Nell is committed to changing. I mean, he knows that the demographics of this country are, you know, shifting very dramatically, and that NPR needs to shift with it, and it needs a greater diversity of voices on there. I think that NPR has become, as I said before, a very insular organization, you know, very much an inside the beltway thing where people stay for a very, very long time.
Right.
And for some strange reason, they've had trouble finding minority voices. And I'm not quite sure why. I don't know whether it's a lack of effort or, as I say, this kind of inside the beltway culture, but it's something that's going to have to change. And one of the reasons that Juan Williams persisted at NPR as long as he did despite their unhappiness with him, was that there were very few black voices there, so they were afraid to do anything about it.
Mm-hmm. And he was a very prominent black voice on the station.
That's right, and he was one of the few.
Exactly. I think NPR could do a better job in that whole area, as we could, too. I'll say that, too. I think we could do the same thing here. We need more of those kinds of voices. What did you make of the way the response to that particular story and then the later story? It was as though NPR couldn't do anything right for about 7 months of last year. They just were. Was it the management that didn't have a clue? Was it they were way too inside the Beltway and too inside their own organization that they didn't see all of this coming, or what? How
well,
was it
I
so
think it
mishandled?
Was, I think it was just kind of an inexperience and a kind of ham-handedness and naivete. They thought that there would be a fuss if Juan Williams were fired, but that it would blow over very, very quickly. And because there have been so many management changes at NPR, nobody has much of an institutional memory, so that you'll remember that when Bob Edwards was fired several years earlier, there was an enormous hue and cry.
Yes.
People are very accustomed to the voice of NPR and the sound of NPR. It becomes part of their lives, and any changes in it, you know, are very disruptive and disturbing to people. And I think that NPR, I think, is a little bit, doesn't quite realize how much of a part of the routine they are for so many people. That's one of the problems. I think that the other problem, in the Juan Williams situation, he had a whole enormous network behind him. You know, he also worked at Fox TV, and Fox TV, of course, has always had a thing for NPR, and was going to maximize the embarrassment of NPR in any way that they could. And so NPR just handed them ammunition.
Yes.
By getting rid of one of Fox TV's own, and so they were going to exploit this as much as they possibly could. And so for days upon days on various Fox shows, on O'Reilly, on Hannity, you know, they made enormous hay of it. And Juan, of course, was right in the middle of that. He was going on there denouncing NPR and, you know, denouncing it in the shrillest possible terms and, you know, basically accusing it of being sort of a nest of left-wingers and bigots,
mm-hmm.
you know, which I think was really very much unfair to NPR. And if you talk to people at NPR, they'll talk about how hard they tried to accommodate Juan Williams over the years. It was a mismatch from the beginning.
Right.
But this was the kind of thing that no one who listens to NPR would ever have realized. And when all of this exploded, NPR had a choice about whether to describe in full the story about their problematic relationship with him or just sort of take it on the chin. And they're used to taking it on the chin, and they took it on the chin, and it made them look very bad. As I say, I think that the marriage between Juan and NPR was a bad one from the very beginning, which is not to say that Juan is not a very bright and industrious and creative and interesting guy, because he's all of those things. But he was stretched very thin. He was trying to do too much. And he wasn't doing the kind of thing for which he'd been hired at NPR. And so it was really a mismatch from the beginning.
So the new management will, you said that Gary will make it a priority to have more minority voices, which might preclude this happening again. If you have a lot of minority voices in your operation, then the thing that happened with Juan Williams wouldn't be as huge a story.
Well, I think that's right, and I think that, you know, if you have a lot of different kinds of voices, there's not one voice that can hold you hostage.
Right.
You know, and your discretion is not curbed in the way that NPR's was. I mean, NPR had a problem with Juan that I describe in the story, and in a way, nonetheless, it was checkmated. It had to tiptoe around. I mean, this is racial politics in the late 20th and early 21st centuries. These situations are very, very delicate, and they're very, very delicate because there are so few minority voices.
We welcome phone calls. We have a full bank of phones humming, and we have some emails as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8255. 855-616-1655. David Margalek is our guest, author, a longtime contributing editor at Vanity Fair. He's also worked for Newsweek and the New York Times. This piece we're talking about, as he said, is not in the magazine. It's online. It is titled National Public Rodeo, and it's in, if you go to Vanity Fair online, you will find his article. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Just a reminder, the president has his State of the Union address. It's tomorrow night, and you will hear NPR's coverage on Wisconsin Public Radio at 8 o'clock tomorrow night, the president's State of the Union address. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Hugh in Milwaukee is our first caller. David, hi, Hugh.
Hi. You know, when NPR was looking for a new CEO, Pat Buchanan was just recently fired by MSNBC. I'm sure he would have brought diversity of thought in a whole new range at NPR. Herman Cain, I'm sure, might be available, too, if you want diversity. The trouble is NPR doesn't want diversity. When is the last time they have ever run a story critical of illegal aliens in this country? All of their stories on the illegals are very, you know, oh, we should sympathize with them and keep them and then have amnesty. What about black crime, black racism particularly? That phrase doesn't even exist in the vocabulary of NPR and their executives. They're all liberal. Their whole agenda is to promote stories and to report stories that are only one-sided. It should not be government-funded. It is a liberal, left-wing news organization.
All right, David.
Well, I think that, you know, first of all, I think that the idea of hiring Pat Buchanan or Herman Cain to head NPR is ridiculous. It's a preposterous idea. I mean, obviously, you don't need a political lightning rod heading NPR from either the left or the right. You need somebody who's sort of down the middle, and this is what they seem to have found. I don't listen constantly to NPR, so I don't know whether the caller's characterizations are correct. I mean, I say in the piece that NPR bends over backwards, really, not to go too far to the left or the right. I think that NPR, in many instances, is very timid. But I do know that there are people on the left and the right feel equally vociferously that NPR is letting them down. I interviewed one fellow who listens to NPR for a living, basically, and critiques it as a left-wing organ. And there's another fellow who listens to it from the left and feels that NPR is a government mouthpiece. So you find people who are equally impassioned on both sides on this.
What would happen to NPR if it did not have government funding?
Well, I think it would be the best thing that could happen to
really?
NPR if it didn't have government funding. And this is one thing I think on which the left and the right should agree. The fellow who was fired as a result of that pseudo-Arab sting, you know, where he went out to lunch and said these embarrassing things about the Tea Party to these would-be Arabs who were going to give money to NPR, was convinced, and I think rightly so, that there's tremendous goodwill to NPR out there in the country. I mean, Joan Kroc gave tens of millions of dollars. McDonald's hamburger heiress gave tens of millions of dollars to NPR. And that if NPR ever got its fundraising house in order, and if the individual member stations of NPR could ever coordinate with national NPR, if you have 28 or 35 or however many millions of people who are listening to you every week, many of whom are very, very affluent, I mean, it seems to me that NPR could wean itself off the government dole quite easily. And then all of these people, particularly people on the right, who are constantly rabble-rousing about the pittance that NPR gets from the government, would be preempted. They'd be shut up. I mean, and I think they'd actually miss it, because it provides them with a very convenient hook for all of their complaints. And NPR would finally be liberated from them, and it would be a good thing for everybody.
Hmm. Well, you look at just the foreign reporting. Thank goodness for that amount of money, because NPR does. I mean, who does this kind of foreign reporting anywhere?
Basically no one does.
You're right.
The remote competitor is the BBC. I mean, I think
right.
The BBC is the best of all radio services. but the BBC isn't available everywhere in the United States. And so NPR, by having however many bureaus it has now, is really indispensable. I mean, while I was waiting to go on this morning, you had a report from Tahrir Square in Cairo.
Right.
You know, I mean, the networks don't have people there right. anymore. They fly people in and out. And so it's an absolutely indispensable part of the American news diet.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that people appreciate it for that. And I think that people would pay for it. There's a lot of money out there for something like NPR. And I think it's all this internecine fighting over funding that's keeping NPR on the government dole, and it's a bad thing.
Hmm. Thanks, Hugh, for the call. William in Madison, hi.
Yes, thank you. I'm shocked that your guest would say that we need to have the uber-rich pay support public radio. Yes, I'm just terribly shocked.
Well, I didn't. Maybe you shouldn't be shocked, because that's not what I said. I said that there are a lot of sources of funding for NPR, and you know, people can make small contributions. I mean, Barack Obama didn't do so badly getting small contributions on the web for his presidential campaign. You know, there are millions of dollars that are available from small funders, too. I'm not suggesting that only the rich contribute to NPR. I mean, if 35 million people or 27 million people listen to it every week and all of them give $10 or $15, that's a hell of a lot of money.
And people do give a lot of money. There's no doubt about that. We go to Mike in Milwaukee next. Hi, Mike.
Oh, Kathleen.
Yeah,
I don't
Mike.
Know what to say.
Well, I hope you can say something, Mike.
He just destroyed me.
What's that?
He just destroyed me. I was going along with him until he started talking about the uber rich funding public radio. And he did say it, basically. He said there's a lot of wealthy contributors, and then he said about the small people. But, you know, in these campaigns, who did Obama listen to? He listened to the pharmaceutical companies. He listened to Goldman Sachs, who sits right in the Oval Office with him. He listened to the bankers. That's who he listened to. He didn't find his comfortable walking shoes to walk with the people who gave the small contributions. The uber rich are the ones that get the say. And the reason I called was, Noam Chomsky, he said something that was really cool. He said, the smart way to keep people passive and obedient is to strictly limit the spectrum of acceptable opinion, but allow very lively debate within the spectrum. And, you know, that's exactly what's been forced upon NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, that it's got the right has orchestrated a movement of people calling in, and you could have a show, Kathleen, on butterflies, and you'd get right-wing people calling in saying, you always have a leftist point of view, and why don't you have somebody with a conservative point of view on butterflies? What's wrong with you? And you get that kind of criticism. For the last 10, 15 years, it's been orchestrated by the known actors in the field that are finally being exposed. And that's what's happened. That's why public broadcasting all across the country has been castrated, basically.
All right, David.
Well, I mean, I don't agree, and I think that getting government funding is every bit as inhibiting for NPR as getting funding from the outside. My own feeling is that because NPR is constantly worried about federal funding, that it's become timorous, and it's afraid to stick its neck out very far. And that's a kind of inhibition, too. So I think that the more sources of money NPR has from the more different kinds of people, the more liberated it would be and the better it would be for everybody.
There is this thing about, you know, it goes on and on and on and on. You get sick of the argument after a while that it's such a leftist organization, you're so liberal, et cetera. I charge anybody to find any. I think it's because we're in this era where all the commercial radio stations are really right wing, and to have a service that talks about, you know, presidents and authors and the civil rights history books that you've done and all kinds of politics from a whole wide range of the political spectrum. You know, it's not as though we're on the air spouting our opinions on everything all the time. We entertain a lot of point of views. You just get sickening after a while of hearing exactly the same criticism.
Well, I think that a lot of it has to do with just the style of NPR. You know, I think that, you know, there's a certain elitist sound to it.
Yeah, I think you're right.
You know,
right.
And I think that that sets certain people off. But I think that my own feeling is that it's really, I find NPR very frustrating sometimes because it's so resolutely down the middle. And I remember, and maybe you'll bleep me out because of this.
No, I won't bleep you out. Just
no,
don't swear.
I remember when I say this in the story, that Leon Panetta called Osama bin Laden a son of a bitch.
Right.
You know, and the word bitch was bleated out. You know, and I thought, who are these people kidding? Who are they afraid of? Who do they think their listeners are? Why are they so scared? You know, and I think part of that is the government funding. And I can't imagine
right.
that, you know, maybe Noam Chomsky is opposed to that, too. I don't know. I mean, does Noam Chomsky favor government funding of NPR?
I really don't know.
You know, I don't know. But I think that, you know, as long as you're on the government dole and the government leash, I think it's a very inhibiting force for NPR. And that NPR should be a place where a thousand flowers should bloom and there should be a great diversity of voices.
Yeah.
And the way to do that is to be financially independent. And I said nothing about fat cats supporting it or principally supporting it. And as you said before, you know, Joan Kroc gave $100 million of McDonald's hamburger money, partly to open foreign bureaus. And I don't think that's been... You know, I don't think that she from the grave is trying to pull her strings, and I don't think that that's tilted NPR to the right or enforced any kind of agenda on NPR. It's liberated NPR.
Yeah. In addition to being somewhat stuffy at times or having a certain pattern, it also is, thank God for it, very smart. I mean, a lot of the people who are on the air are really smart people, and the radio they put together may seem a little stuffy at times, but it's pretty thorough and it's pretty accurate, and you know that people have, because they've been there so long, a long history of covering certain subjects.
Well, I think that's right, and I think that, as I say, that a lot of the opposition to NPR is just pure anti-intellectualism in a way. People think that because it's elite, it may sound snooty, they resent it, but in fact, there's a hell of a lot of solid reporting on NPR, which
right.
is what makes it indispensable. Now, I don't think that NPR is crazy necessarily about the story that I wrote. I don't mean to be a shill for NPR.
No, I don't think they are crazy about it.
But I think that it's vastly better than 90% of the stuff that's out there. And that's why it's become so important, and that's why it's important to all of us, and it's important to understand what's been going on there in the last few years. And how dangerous it is that when NPR is vulnerable, I think American democracy suffers for it.
Thanks, Mike, for the call. Frank in Madison. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi, Frank.
This is a superb discussion. I'm afraid my copy of Vanity Fair didn't arrive, so I haven't read the article.
It's online, Frank. You won't find it in the magazine. So, there you go.
Check it out.
Okay.
I would point out, and I hope this isn't redundant, that NPR and public broadcasting in the United States is sort of a half creature of something that is found elsewhere. The BBC, CBC, ABC are these mandated, publicly funded public broadcasting systems that are by law required to be independent, and they are regularly speakers of truth to power. And there's a common gambit. You often see this on the BBC, where some minister is asked the equivalent of, have you stopped beating your spouse, as the opening gambit on a topic. And she will have to respond, and does, routinely. And I think that one of the problems with NPR, as your guest points out, is that it's way too timid, but I would say that adequate funding and a stronger mandate is required, and things like all things considered, are actually only a few things considered. So thank you.
Thank you, Frank. As always, great to hear from you. David.
I agree with him. I mean, I think that in some ways, the range of stories is too narrow, and one is very rarely surprised by something that one hears on NPR, which is not to say that what's on there is not interesting. And I've had as many driveway moments, as they say, as the next person. You know, I mean, there are many stories that I listen to on NPR where you literally don't want to get out of the car until it's over.
How true. Here's something that we hear frequently. So let me get this one to you from Gary in Iron River. Further to your comment that you're missing minority voices on NPR, your liberal staff does a good job of representing them. What you really need is a conservative voice, or at least a voice where it is impossible to detect their political leanings. Everyone I can think of at NPR and WPR have a significant liberal progressive leaning. While I understand many try to be balanced and neutral, it's impossible to do so for most people. For the life of me, I can't understand why you don't get a few conservative folks so you can blunt the criticism that you are biased toward the left.
Well, you know, one situation that's changed at NPR is that there's much less commentary on it than there used to be. You know, it used to be that they didn't have as many reporters and they weren't as prosperous or as large, and so they filled a lot of airtime with commentary from Daniel Shore and other people. And now there's just generally much more news reporting, and maybe people are picking up a liberal bias from that. But, you know, it's not as simple as hiring Pat Buchanan just to spout off a conservative point of view. I mean, you hire the reporters. There's a certain category of person who wants to be a reporter at NPR. It's the same at the New York Times and the other elite media. I mean, I was a reporter on the New York Times for 15 years. I mean, I don't know what determines this, but most of the reporters on the New York Times would vote Democratic. There's no conspiracy here. It just seems to be the kinds of people that go out for that kind of work. And I suppose that somebody hiring at NPR might take that into account and find, you know, and look for people who are somewhat different on the political spectrum. But these people are reporting. They're not pontificating or opining. They're reporting stories, and their political orientation is not supposed to be their principal attribute. Their principal attribute is supposed to be able to go out and dig up facts. So I think that those people who think that the commentary on NPR should be balanced have a good point, but the point is that there's not that much commentary anymore on the network.
Mm-hmm. Daniel Shore, what was the story on Daniel Shore? Did they want Daniel Shore, who I loved and would tune in Scott Simon's show specifically to listen to him because of his breadth of experience and because he was in his 90s? How was he able to broadcast for such a long period of time?
Well, I think that he was such a venerable figure, and he came from, you know, he had this journalistic pedigree, and he was just somebody. Probably NPR in its current incarnation would be afraid to hire Daniel Shore, but he had been there for so long and had literally been grandfathered in that he became a fixture. And I think that he supplied some gray hair and some wisdom to the place. And I like to listen to him too. I think I mentioned in the story that he came to sort of a sad end at NPR.
Yes.
I think he was quite incapacitated when he was on there, and they had to tape him in advance and sort of splice together his commentary. It sounded better than it originally was. Of course, that's true for a lot of us who've been interviewed at NPR. The things are not done live, and they end up making us sound better than we really are, or more articulate than they really are. But he was really, you know, he was kind of running out of gas there towards the end. And I described the sort of unhappy end that he had there. But he died sort of shortly thereafter anyway, and so it really didn't make that much difference. But if the story of what had happened to Daniel Shore at the end of his career at NPR had come out, it would have caused, you know, a hue and cry, much like the one that greeted the dismissal of Juan Williams, because he did have that devoted a following.
Yes. Yeah, a lot of people listened to him. He was worth listening to. Joe in Madison. Hi.
Good morning.
Hi, Joe.
Hey, I love NPR. As it stated on the program before, on the regular news, they give a 30 or a 4-second snippet on something, and NPR goes into greater depth. I've heard them interview two different opposing sides. I think NPR is fabulous, but it does worry me that when now the in selecting new people are looking for minorities is almost like intentionally trying to pick a bias. So rather than saying, wow, we needed a minority, broader view, is to, regardless, blue, green, yellow, orange, red, get a person that doesn't have a strong bias and continues doing what you're doing. And if you don't mind my head, that's one point, but I would like to, because you had asked before, you'd like someone to tell you or explain to you where it is a little bit liberal. I think that the Terry Gross's Fresh Air, and if you want me to tell you how I think that, I'll be glad to do it. But overall, my biggest message is I think that NPR is great, and to start looking for drastic changes, it may not have all the positive results that we're hoping for. I think it's great, and I really don't want to see many changes, to tell you the truth.
All right, thank you, Joe.
I would differentiate between NPR's news operation and individual NPR programs, some of which are produced by NPR and some of which are not. You know, and I don't think it would be a bad, I mean, maybe Terry Gross is liberal. I don't think it would necessarily be a bad idea to have, you know, a talk show with someone who's more conservative than that. But I don't think that, you know, a pervasive liberal bias influences NPR's news coverage, which is, I think, what most people listen to it for. The news at the top of the hour and All Things Considered and Morning Edition, I think they bend over backwards, sometimes too far to be absolutely in the middle.
Joe, thanks for the call. We need to pause for a moment and we'll return. We're speaking about National Public Rodeo. It is the piece, the title of the piece that David Margalek wrote in the Vanity Fair online version. You can find it online on Vanity Fair. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our lines are busy, but keep in mind, and just keep trying, and I hope you get through. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. President Obama's State of the Union address will be broadcast on Wisconsin Public Radio tomorrow night at 8. And for those of you who love presidential history, which I must confess that I'm one of those, the book on James Madison, our fourth president, Richard Brookhiser, will be with us to talk about James Madison Wednesday at 10 o'clock. Back to phone calls for David, and let's go next to Dennis in Beloit. Hi, Dennis.
Yes, hey, thank you for the show. Three cheers to your guest for suggesting NPR get off government funding. I think more organizations ought to do that. It'd be liberating. But my comment concerns Juan Williams. I appreciated Juan's commentary, and I'm no kid, so I have... I could sense that Juan was difficult, but I felt the handling of his dismissal was rather disingenuous by NPR, because when listening to Scott Simon's, everyone's favorite Saturday morning show, in 2003, when without saying he was not stating the views of NPR, he went on quite a long soliloquy as to the justness of the Iraq War and how he, even as a Quaker, felt that this was a just war. And I was very disappointed that he didn't indicate that, because I came away from that feeling that NPR was endorsing strongly the Iraq War. And to me, good journalism and reporting, regardless if you're to the right or to the left, you should indicate that this is my personal point of view and not the view of the station. And I was disappointed, and I hope that Scott Simon was it was a teachable moment for him, because I was extremely disappointed. As far as I'm concerned, NPR took a position, and I'd like to ask Scott Simon if that's still his position.
But would you have objected if he had said that and that was his opinion, or would you object to the fact that he even said anything, that opinion is not, has no place on NPR?
No, I would not have objected.
I see.
I may not have agreed.
Okay.
However, I think that's pretty important, and I would say the same for commentators on the right, which is why I seldom ever watch Fox News. But I think that's important, and I'd be interested
okay.
in your guest observations.
Thank you, Dennis.
Well, I think that the caller is right that NPR was disingenuous about Juan Williams. And I think that's part of what I try to explain in the story. I think that NPR had a long list of grievances against Juan Williams that went back 10 years. And there were many instances in which they were dissatisfied with the work that he did. Substantive journalistic disagreements with him, either over what he said on Fox TV or over the reporting and work that he did at NPR. But none of that came up when they fired him. You know, the reason they fired him was the comment that he made on Fox about his reluctance to get on an airplane if he saw somebody wearing Arab garb, as he put it. This is something that he said on the Bill O'Reilly show. And in some ways, it was a very honest comment that he made. It was a sentiment that many people shared, and he quickly clarified that it was, you know, that one shouldn't judge people en masse, and that it was dangerous to stereotype people. And in a way, on balance, it was an inoffensive comment. But what happened was that NPR was really dissatisfied with his work for many, many years, but they didn't say that, okay? And none of that came out. So that's something that I outline in the story. So in that sense, I think that their explanation was disingenuous and incomplete, and it hurt them very badly because it made them seem intolerant.
Mm-hmm. Let's try to get a couple more calls in. We're jammed here, and we're running short on time. Tim in Elm Grove, hi.
Good morning. A couple of quick points. One relates to the quality of journalism topic that's been going through. And my eyes were really open several years ago when I saw an interview with Walter Cronkite, and he was asked about the political future of the U.S., and he paused, and I don't remember his exact words, but essentially he said, I'm not sure if the American public has the intellectual tools anymore to do the logical analysis of what's going on, that it's far too rooted in emotion. My second point is just quantification of certain opinions or beliefs, like NPR is funded by fat cats. Well, NPR, I'm sure, could say we get 1 million donations a year, 700,000 of those donations are $25 and under, or, you know, and these are meaningless numbers I'm coming up with. They're just for example. And then the second thing is what I call the myth of the liberal media. If one were to take a look at who owns various news outlets, Wall Street Journal, Fox News, many radio stations, and I think you could quantify the fact that it really, the United States has a far more conservative media than most people believe. So,
all right, David.
Well, I mean, I think that's true, but I think it comes back to the point that many of the people who work for for these corporate behemoths, I mean, people like me, you know, we're Democrats, and I think that as I say, the people who work for the networks, not Fox Network, but the other networks, probably if in the privacy of the voting booth, I think probably most of them vote Democratic, and the question is whether that infiltrates their reporting. And I think that's a fair question. It's a very subtle point, but I don't think that any of them, including NPR, has a clear liberal agenda. And I think that, you know, again, it's a very convenient whipping boy, and now Newt Gingrich is the most recent to exploit it. There's a great resentment out there for elitism of any kind,
yes,
and elite institutions and, yeah, and institutions like NPR. And there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of political hay to be made by attacking them. And yet when you listen even to the conservative watchdogs who listen to NPR all the time trying to find, you know, blatant examples of political bias, they're really hard-pressed to come up with a very impressive list.
David, thank you so much. I knew it was going to be a really good conversation with you, and it has been. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen.
David Margolick, our guest, he's been with us before. We talked to him in December, you'll recall, when he was talking about his really wonderful book, Elizabeth and Hazel, Two Women of Little Rock. He worked for the New York Times for a number of years. He is a longtime contributing editor at Vanity Fair. The piece you find online, and it is National Public Rodeo, and an interesting piece. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Great conversations as we continue here on this Monday on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'll be with you again tomorrow at 9 o'clock. Thanks for listening.